Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University. Offering 1 to 2 year master's degree programs in business administration, healthcare leadership, and servant leadership. Viterbo.edu/graduate. Support for WPR comes from Bagels Forever, available fresh daily at the store in Madison and the frozen food case in grocery stores throughout the state. Bagels and bagel chips can be shipped anywhere in the U.S. at bagelsforever.com.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time for another tech update with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He's also a volunteer handler for the SANS Internet Storm Center. And we've lots of things to talk about with him. Fact-checking on posts on Facebook and Instagram is ending. TikTok could be banned in the U.S. as soon as next week. So there's lots to visit about. And certainly we can answer your technology questions as we move along. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let's talk about Meta first. Meta owns Facebook and Instagram, Threads, WhatsApp, quite a few things, actually. And Mark Zuckerberg, who is the CEO of Meta, said the company is going to stop fact-checking members' posts on its platforms, Facebook and Instagram. What's his reasoning for this?
Yeah, there are a couple of reasons for the change. One was due to either user feedback or elsewhere regarding potentially having too much moderation, too many potentially what they call false positives, where maybe there is a post or a thread that otherwise was safe or benign, but was removed. And so one of the reasons given was we're actually blocking too much stuff, and a lot of stuff or individuals that shouldn't be blocked, well, they're being blocked. We'd like to reduce the likelihood of that happening. That was probably really one of the central points in terms of making a change, was just reducing, blocking items that otherwise shouldn't have been blocked, or creating a situation where too much of the content was moderated, not necessarily for safety reasons. And those are primarily the reasons. It comes at an interesting time, just with the inauguration of a new president and a variety of other things. So I think there's other correlations in terms of potential reasoning, but the reasons given really were for, complaints from a variety of people of, too much stuff is getting blocked. We'd like to try to reduce the likelihood of that happening.
So he's going to replace it with a system that operates like community notes. What they do on X, or formerly Twitter, how's that going to work?
And that's a really good question. And a lot of the items, I think anything community driven has, its pros and cons. So there's benefits to allowing people to kind of self-moderate content on any of the social media platforms. I think the challenge around that is it still also introduces a similar bias that might also be created by the creation of these posts. Information that might otherwise be considered, let's say, misinformation, disinformation, or even potentially hate speech is also being moderated by those that might introduce those same artifacts. So I think there's a potential challenge there. There can be pluses because people are able to add their own, kind of ruling their own input mm-hmm. into those pieces. But it still creates that same challenge where it's hard to self-moderate, right? You need an external objective source to really do that. And while there's some use to it, it kind of reduces or eliminates really that objective voice that can help to make a consistent decision for everyone. So that consistency is really lost.
I read that the new guidelines would allow its social media users to accuse gay and transgender people from being mentally ill, or accuse them of being mentally ill.
There's and from the listing and the changes, one of the things they noted is the items they're going to be looking to moderate centrally are going to be the quote unquote most severe items. So the items that are considered to be, I guess, more risky or more detrimental, more dangerous to the community than other pieces. And that piece of it seems to have, you know, come outside of those centralized guidelines for hate speech specifically.
Yeah.
Which is, from an opinion of mine, you know, challenging for to help to make that inclusive for individuals and to make people feel safe in that environment. But that was the decision made in this case with moderating that content.
People have been responding to this, many in a kind of a negative way. What are you hearing?
Yeah, and I think with just about any of these kinds of decisions, there are always going to be opinions on the entire spectrum in terms of in favor or opposition. And so we'll continue to hear really a wide breadth of opinions on the matter. I think one of the items that people really talk about, and when people post on any kind of social media platform, there's one item in terms of free speech and being able to voice opinions, but then there's kind of a difference between misinformation or disinformation and actively creating a dangerous situation for other individuals. And I think some of those life safety concerns, in addition to simply allowing people to feel welcome and included, are kind of being lumped in with this misinformation, disinformation. And so it's kind of a challenging situation in terms of where this is going. And I think there's just going to be a lot of individuals that simply they're not going to feel safe on that platform. They're probably not going to want to be in that platform. And I think one of the items that's going to be challenging is if those individuals or those groups of people that don't feel safe, if they leave the platform demographics are going to shift, and it's actually going to create probably a more biased environment where there's a lot of individuals kind of thinking the same thing, really all the only ones there. And it just becomes an echo chamber of those voices. And so in the long term, if that happens, it'll actually reduce the inclusion of free speech because it'll force people to leave it and create potential bias in that one platform. We'll only know as kind of time moves forward, but I think that's one of the challenges in this case is if people don't feel safe and they leave, that creates a situation where while it's stated free speech is available, the people to give differing opinions don't exist.
Mm. Willem in Colfax has something. Hi, Willem.
I'm concerned just about the whole internet. I'm 74 years old, so I grew up without the internet. And I grew up in a time when there was still the fairness doctrine on radio stations and television stations, which also no longer exists. So it's hard enough being a teenager in the world before, but now people say these horrible, mean things on the internet, and it's really hard on people, physically hard and mentally hard. And then we have the president-elect, who's not exactly known for honesty, is going to be able to say really harmful things, like the lies that they said about Haitian refugees eating cats and dogs, and those people's lives became threatened, and You know, I just don't see it as a good thing, and there are limits on free speech. You can't, you know, the classic example of yelling fire in a crowded room. You can't. So all these conspiracy theories, you know, stories about the radical left. I had a neighbor who had a sign, lock and load, things are going to get nasty. All this kind of mean-spirited is not good for our society. It's not good for our country. It's not good for the world. And this just amplifies all that.
Jesse comments, he mentioned the Fairness Doctrine, which this went out, I think, under President Reagan, where if on radio and television, if you had you were expressing a view that was controversial, you had to have others with opposing views to discuss that. And the kind of silos you were talking about with social media here is pretty much what happened when the Fairness Doctrine. Over time, we have news silos.
Yeah, and I think that's it, and it's going to be probably a continual challenge. I think this is one of those things too. We'll likely see as kind of a cycle, right? Things will kind of sway one direction or another over time. And so we'll see kind of concerns being revisited. And I think, you know, in this case, I think there's a benefit to understanding different viewpoints. The way in which we engage in that, I think, is really important. So I think there's, you know, the potential for misinformation, disinformation being kind of discussed, even though one might consider it's not really a discussion. It's either fact or it's not. But then I think there's the way people engage in it, which also can fit into that, hate speech category, where if are people even engaging in the topic in an ethical and a open manner and not actually speaking in negative terms about other people and actually engaging in the topic, I think all of these are potentially challenging. And it will be, it will make potentially some of that discourse a little bit more challenging, and it will not invite people to actually engage in some of those topics. So I do see it as potentially challenging. I think people would also note that there are challenges even with opposing viewpoints, depending on what the viewpoint is, because there are viewpoints that may be explicit in terms of life safety, hate speech that kind of go against also allowing kind of inclusive and welcoming environments. And I think this will be a challenge for Meta, and I mean, it has been a challenge for Meta, and it's going to be a challenge for other social media applications and organizations that are just out there in the world.
Yeah. Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, our guest today as we take a look at issues in technology. You may have a question as well as we move along. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at technology on the program today with our guest, Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Questions for him? Maybe you've got an issue with your own technology you want to ask about. I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. And just a quick note, at 12:30 today, we'll talk to UW-Madison audiologist Rachel Lee about the latest advancements in hearing aid technology, and there's a lot in that area, so it'd be fun talking with Rachel Lee later on. But right now, it's technology. I want to turn to TikTok for a minute. It's got to be one of the most popular formats that we have here. About 170 million Americans, I think, are on TikTok. It's about half our population in the U.S. And it could be shut down on January 19th unless the Supreme Court intervenes. What's likely to happen there with TikTok?
Well, it seems like at this point, so right now, I do not believe we have any information in terms of whether there will be some kind of intervention with the law coming into place on the 19th. If things do kind of move forward as is, it is likely that at least within the United States, TikTok will kind of slowly become unusable. So for a variety of reasons, one, during this, when this comes into effect, or if this comes into effect, the TikTok platform will not be able to be hosted on any kind of U.S. infrastructure. So the availability and what that allows for how many people to connect to it simply will not be available in the United States. Application updates will not be able to be deployed, and people who may want to download the application, you know, whether they're using an iPhone, Android device, they won't be able to download the application. So for people who are currently using it, they might be able to use it for a while, but it may become eventually slow or unusable as time moves forward. So we're likely going to see a lot of people in the U.S. really not be able to use the application. And people may try to find other ways to use it, especially if it's only available in areas such as the UK, Australia, wherever. And basically anywhere outside of the US, they might try to use virtual private networks or other technologies to look like they're on another network so they can use the application. I'm not sure how many people are actually going to do that. That is an extra step people would have to do in order to try to even use the application, depending on how things are applied. That may or may not be illegal, just based on kind of the national security concerns around the TikTok platform. So we'll definitely know more as time moves forward. We've got a little bit over a week until that date hits. But we will, if that does come up, people who are using it are probably going to slowly see that service degrade, slow down, and at some point maybe just become completely inaccessible.
I know, I think most people use TikTok for entertainment, but it's quite a number of people operate businesses on the platform. You wonder how that might affect the economy.
Yeah, and that's it's an item that'll be interesting when this kind of moves forward. It's likely a lot of people will simply move to other platforms in order to try to do the same thing. But it's, you know, we'll find out as time moves forward.
I guess we will. I think actually President-elect Trump asked the Supreme Court to prevent the forced sale of, what was his reasoning on that? Do you know?
Yeah, and I think he wanted to try to explore a political option for TikTok. I don't think there were details in terms of actually what that was, but to try to basically find another solution to not ban the platform. And I think there might be other reasons that President-elect Trump would be interested in doing that, either also for his own potential followers on that platform. And this right now, the ban is really set to be on the 19th of January. Inauguration is going to be the day after. So I know there is a lot of commentary in terms of the timing as well. So this could happen the day before. But also looking at other information that's been provided in different media outlets, there's no there didn't seem to be a legal precedent for basically waiting until President-elect Trump was in office. So we'll see how that is, too.
I want to turn to take a look at sort of the fires going on in California. I mean, large population areas in California have been affected by this. And technology, certainly, I mean, if your house burns down and all of your whole neighborhood burns down, There's got to be, hopefully, there are ways that people can use technology to protect themselves within the moment, at least.
Yeah, and I think, and this is, and it's a devastating situation for individuals that are kind of in this situation. We always, at least we try to plan for technology to fail, which is usually probably a good thing to keep in mind during any kind of natural disaster situation or any situation where there might just simply be a power outage for a short period of time. You know, when things do break, what do you do? So if you don't have a cell phone service, for example, what can you do to communicate with others? So do you have another option to get to the internet, to communicate through a different platform? And maybe it's Facebook because you have family and friends that are on Facebook. Maybe it's through Signal because you have other individuals or have created a backup plan to communicate using that application. So really having those backup methods for communication is probably one of the most important, either with family or friends or even with individuals or organizations that might you might need help from. And so it could be police, fire, or other emergency response, how you communicate with them. And I think especially when if you do have cell phone towers that are, you know, physically located in an area, if you were to have large fires, what is the impact on that infrastructure when they're going through that same area? How is it impacting the availability of cell phone service and everything else? And outside of the destruction of that infrastructure, usually during these instances, the infrastructure is simply used more as well. So it can create bottlenecks in terms of who can use it just because everyone's basically in that emergency state and it can actually overwhelm those services. And so, you know, having a backup method, being able to use maybe not even your cellular service, but if you have the internet, using a voice over IP or VoIP solution to be able to make a phone call or to reach out to somebody can be really important. And that's just from the communication aspect. We're not even talking about simply having power for devices, having safety equipment like flashlights or anything else. And
portable chargers come to mind.
Yeah, and portable chargers are extremely important. So, I mean, even for me, I have a cell phone. I can connect to the internet. I can call people. I could call people using a VoIP solution. So let's say Google Voice, for example, or other solutions out there. I also have a flashlight on it. So it starts becoming, my cell phone's a multi-tool now for all of these different things. But when the battery dies, what happens? What do I do? And so being able to have, whether it's battery packs, generators, and I think especially for, in this case, you can't really necessarily take a big generator with you, but having the capability of taking something with you, you can at least recharge smaller devices or you can keep a laptop powered for an extended period of time can be extremely useful because it tends to be the one thing that can connect to all this other infrastructure for communications. And I think for most people, a cell phone is probably one of those need to have when we want to communicate with somebody.
Yeah, and the Red Cross and FEMA both have apps that provide emergency updates, for example, and they direct people to the help they may need. I think these could be valuable apps to have.
Yeah, and those are really good points too. So, and a lot of them are going to be, so depending on whether it is an iOS device, right? An Apple iPhone, iPad, or an Android device, being able to go on the App Store, download the apps that are directly from those organizations. So I'm always telling everyone, be careful about downloading an incorrect application.
Yeah.
So if you go actually to the American Red Cross website, which is at redcross.org, they will actually have a direct link to the application to make sure you're getting the right one. Usually when you search, you're probably only going to see one anyway with a lot more user base and more feedback. But having those applications on your phone mean that you're able to connect to them right away. Many of them may have push notifications, which might also be specific to your location. So a lot of apps will actually know physically where you are based upon your connection to cell phone towers and other equipment, and can notify you when you might need to know something timely, kind of similar to other emergency notification services, which are built into phones these days, so you can actually receive those on a timely basis. But having those apps can be useful, one, to get information, but also plan. So if you do have a situation, they'll also have guides in terms of what you need to think about or how you need to plan, whether it's for something that's happening right now or you're just thinking about it and want to make sure that when the time comes, you're prepared.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, talking technology with him. And you can join in, too. We're going to talk about privacy protection coming up. Maybe you have a question relating to that or another IT question. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you as we talk with Jesse. Let's turn to protecting your personal information online. It can be challenging. How can people prevent unauthorized access to their data?
Yeah, one of the best ways, and usually this is just understanding what data of yours may be out there. So I do recommend go to a web browser, go to Google, go to another search engine. I'd actually recommend if you do, you know, if you want to go to Bing, you want to go to Google, maybe there's another search engine you want to use, because each search engine might show different results. Google your name, search for your name, see what information comes up. Really, and that's to understand what information about you may already be out there. And if there is more information out there that you would want to remove, it at least gives you an idea, maybe a list in terms of, you know, this website has my information. How do I remove it from there? And you can start building a plan based upon what you already see. That being said, there's a lot of websites out there that might actually put your information out there by default. And it might be your address, it might be your name. A lot of information, you know, we work in cities, counties, states, countries, you know, it keeps on going up. Some of the information for tax records may be public, which means some of your data might be out there in terms of where you live or what you have to deal with. So I've seen that for property information could be public information. You might not be able to search for it on Google, but you might actually be able to find it through your state, county, or city records. So I also kind of recommend looking in those areas, because some of that public information may simply be out there. And by default, it may be, you need to say, I don't want it shared, but it may be shared by default. And so anytime you I sign up for a new application, maybe it's an online app, maybe it is for a new service I want to purchase, or maybe even for credit, what are the, and usually there's going to be a privacy area in your sign-up form, and it's going to say maybe how they share or don't share your data, but there also might be an opt-in or opt-out. So yes, I would like my data shared, or no, I would not like my data shared. And right now it may not be consistent. So they may decide to share by default unless you say no, or, which would be my preference, they decide not to share your data unless you say yes. Yeah. And I think that difference between kind of the opt-in, which means that we're not going to share it and you have to tell us if you want that shared, or the opt-out, which is they're going to share it by default and you decide to tell them you don't want it shared. I'm hoping that opt-in model will be much more consistent. Right now, a lot of the privacy laws have gaps, especially within the United States. I think the California's CCPA to try to limit that data from being exposed, I think, is important. Same thing with the GDPR. From the European Union. But all those privacy laws are different and they're different per location. It becomes really, really confusing. But there are, I think, a lot of organizations that are trying to do the right thing, which is we're not going to share your data unless you tell us to, or, you know, for improvement of services or for other things. So keep a look at those. Whenever you sign up for something, there's probably a checkbox somewhere, whether you opt in or opt out of a service. Even when logging into Windows for the first time, you'll even have the location services, everything else. So any of the features that, honestly, they do try to make the service more usable for you. They try to learn what you do. They try to know what you, how you use your technology and where you use it from. It really is used at least partially to improve the services, but that data might also get shared up to third parties. And with that information, it may be made a little bit more public or might otherwise be usable by others simply by paying a fee. And data brokers are all over the place. So one of the best ways to at least limit it is say no and opt out of those services if they're by default opted in. Try to remove the information that's shared with other organizations. Otherwise, trying to find what's out there on the internet is always a good idea to see what can people find out about you. The challenge is others can also share your information. So if somebody else happens to be on Facebook, on a different social media site, or they're using a service that they might be entering your information, and maybe it's for contact lists, it's another avenue to potentially have that data get out there. So that can be a challenge. And in those cases, there are services that will assist to try to remove that information for you. Some of those come at a cost. Some of them may also be more or less reputable, just like a lot of services out there. And trying to keep information off of the internet, or at least to limit its public exposure, it's kind of a continual work. You might Google yourself today and see nothing. You might Google yourself tomorrow and see 10 things or two things. And that changes over time. So it's something, it's one of those reasons I think a lot of those services are probably very appealing, is because they do offer service plans where you pay monthly and they continually try to remove this information from the internet for you, trying to take a lot of that work off of what you need to do and to keep your data private. So I can see why some of those would be beneficial, but it's, and unfortunately, it's an ongoing challenge because all the data on the internet changes, and what's there tomorrow, what's there today may be gone tomorrow, but new data gets introduced all the time as well.
Yeah, it's always it's a little irritating. I might be online to look for something relating to a show that I'm doing, or I might be looking for a gift for a friend or a relative, and then suddenly I've got all kinds of ads that sort of relate to what I was searching for.
Right. And that's I was even thinking about this for, you know, whether it's Facebook or other platforms, there's a lot of privacy settings. So I always recommend for anyone, go through your privacy settings, make sure they make sense to you. It can also determine how people can share content about you. So in Facebook and a lot of other platforms, you can tag other people. There are settings to actually kind of disallow other people to tag you, which can limit some of the data they can share or how it can be connected to you. So I do recommend people go through privacy settings, and kind of with the opting out too. If you do live in a location where you have multiple people living in the same place, all of a sudden you might start getting each other's ads. And so let's say you are shopping for somebody else. They might all of a sudden find out because you just happen to be in the same location using the same internet connection, and that information gets exposed because a lot of these companies are, they're constantly collecting information. They're constantly trying to connect it to other data sources and really to kind of help you along with, hey, here's another way you can get this. The downside is it inadvertently gets shared with others because they're also using your internet. They may have or may not have similar search terms or maybe using similar devices. So there's a lot of ways that the data can be represented to others, and that can unintentionally expose data to people you know.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest today. Questions for him. We're talking technology, of course. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You hear terms first party, third party cookies. I think the third party cookies relate to advertisers, but can you explain the difference on that?
Yeah, normally, so if I'm going to a website, and let's say it's I'm going to a website. Let's say it's redcross.org. So I'm going to their website. I want to download their application. Well, a first party cookie might be from Red Cross itself. So they might want to make sure they can identify you and serve you information that's only for you, and so they know it's yours. There might be another link to another service on that website, which might be third party. So it could be, for example, Google Play or the App Store from Apple. And those could be third-party sites that may have their own tracking cookies. I think one thing that's very common with websites is also Google Analytics, which people use all the time to understand how do people interact with my website. And part of it's to know the volume of people using the site, how useful it is, but also to improve it. So maybe people just don't go to one area of the website because there's just no link to it. No one knows where it is. And so those tools help to give people an understanding of where those gaps might be. But that could be considered a third party because it's not the actual website you're navigating. It's a tool on the back end that's going somewhere else.
Okay.
And it could be advertisers. It could be other third party resources from your website. But generally, it's going to be something for a website that's not directly in that URL you see in the top of your screen. So it's not going to be from redcross.org. It's going to be from a different resource. And all sorts of websites, it's probably pretty rare. It'd actually be interesting to see a study about it. I bet when you go to any website, there is likely a third-party website being referenced in some way, shape, or form, which also might include a third-party cookie if they're delivering that to help understand how you're accessing the website. And actually going through even the FEMA website, when they have information about the FEMA app, there's actually a link to YouTube, which is right there. And so, you know, there might be a third-party cookie there from Google because they manage that service. So you're going to see them all over the place. But usually when you go to a website, most people would tend to think the first party cookies, the website I'm navigating to, are the most trusted because I'm explicitly going there. I'm purposefully, want to see this content. The third party cookies, it doesn't mean they are less trusted, but their content that kind of comes along for the ride. It's something that still might be intentionally put on the website, but it is coming from another location. So that's always something to keep in mind. And any of those cookies, they try to kind of understand who's navigating the website. So you get the same experience every time. But those cookies can also be used for tracking and other information, either to kind of store some of that tracking information on your device or even to collect some of that to be reused for other purposes.
Justin in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Justin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I know that they collect all of this data from us about where we're, what we're browsing to, what we're looking at, et cetera. And like Facebook sells blocks of shared data to different companies. How much is my data worth to these when these companies buy it?
Yeah, interesting question.
Yeah, that's an it. So, and there's probably two ways to answer it. So, how much is your data worth, and how much do they pay? So, to actually get the data, a lot of it is actually really, really inexpensive. It might be. And I actually don't know what the total price would be. It probably depends on the data broker. But they can actually, to purchase bulk blocks of data about individuals, can actually be pretty inexpensive. And part of this is legitimate through companies that resell data. It might be Meta. It might be Google. It might be, you know, name your company that's collecting and reselling the information. It can be purchased pretty inexpensively. In terms of the value, well, that depends on what services or products they're able to sell for that. And I think there's revenue to be generated both from the sale of the information, but there's also data, or there's money to be made from the data that people are buying, because they're able to advertise information for products or services to consume that helps them to generate revenue. Unfortunately, the data is really, really inexpensive to purchase. And there are a variety of ways to actually go ahead purchasing that data, either by going through the right channels, being an organization that wants to consume from those data brokers, but we also see it on the illegal side of things. So individuals that are selling sensitive information for individuals, whether it's credit card data, social security numbers, addresses, whatever that might be, to get information for an individual might be less than a dollar. And when you think about trying to get that sensitive information, and for one person it's less than a dollar, well, it's kind of scary that it's easy to get that information. Just it's all about knowing where to find it and how to procure it. But people are doing that on a regular day-to-day basis. So I'd say it's worth a lot, but that's why they usually buy information from a lot of people. And I think that's they know people are either not going to buy or sell, or they're not going to, you know, procure services, so they're not going to generate any revenue for the individuals. And so when people tend to buy the data, they buy it in bulk, and they really broadcast that to a large audience. But yeah, person by person, it tends to be, unfortunately, pretty cheap to get.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Tomorrow at this time, we'll be talking about maintaining mental health and optimism during the winter and abstaining a bit from alcohol. Also talk to Lynn Peebles about her new book, The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. That's tomorrow. Right now, looking at technology, and if you have an issue, a problem, or just a question about technology, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Jan in Cross Plains. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I'm an 80-year-old internet user and doing quite well, except for the fact that somewhere along the line between my business and our home computers, I got mixed up with OneDrive. And I'm having trouble because the OneDrive at the store at our business is now the OneDrive under my husband's email at home, and I can't access my OneDrive at home, and I can't unravel it. So I'm needing some help.
Okay.
Yeah, that one's... And this can happen quite a bit. So OneDrive for data storage can be used for personal use, home use. Many people might have multiple accounts, and I think that's where a lot of the challenge can come in. They have something on Windows and Mac called the OneDrive Sync client, which allows you to kind of navigate it like any folder on your system, so you can easily get to it. Downside is if you have multiple accounts, clicking on a link can create everything to synchronize in weird ways, and it becomes really, really confusing. Probably recommend in this case, there's a couple ways to go about it. I would recommend using either different web browsers to try to access both the work and personal accounts. This needs to be done too if you're using Chrome, Firefox, Edge. They'll usually have something called incognito or in private mode, and those are meant to basically not maintain any of the settings that you might already have for logged in systems. And a lot of that can kind of create some confusion. Log into your work OneDrive in one window, log into your personal OneDrive in another window, and it'll allow you to see both. I'm guessing when you see both of them, at least from the web interface, because that's the other way you can access it, hopefully you don't see data from either one in those views. If you do, the challenge will be removing it from the OneDrive of the either work or personal folder. What I usually recommend, so for anything, whenever you're trying to do data cleanup, if you feel it's been duplicated or uploaded on another service, I get really paranoid. So what I'll usually do, the first thing I'll do before starting to delete things, is make a full backup of everything. So when you're actually in OneDrive, you should be able to either download the folders. Otherwise, if you do accidentally delete something, it's going to show it in the deleted items folder, and you should be able to restore it for 30 days. And that's going to be the default for any work or for any personal storage. But I view it on those web interfaces to see if you can kind of deconflict the two, at least know what normal looks like in each one of those accounts. And then if you need to remove any data, the biggest challenge, because I think this is probably where you're seeing more of the conflict, is the OneDrive sync client itself. So if you're on Windows, you're going to see it in the lower right. It's usually going to be the little cloud. If you hit the start menu and type in OneDrive, it should show up and you can open it. When you're in that OneDrive client, they do have different settings or preferences you can have for the client, including managing storage. You'll want to go through the settings to see if you have two accounts listed. My guess is that you may actually have both accounts being synchronized by that client, which is probably kind of creating the confusion between which of those accounts do I actually see the data for and where is it stored? And you might want to actually remove one of those or potentially even clear out the settings completely for the OneDrive sync client. The nice thing is if you do remove the settings for the OneDrive sync client, it doesn't impact your actual data stored in OneDrive. It's still online. It's still there. You might currently also be able to navigate it from your cell phone. That's something else I might consider taking a look at as well. But take a look at your existing OneDrive sync client preferences. It will also tell you, it'll have an account box. So if you do go to preferences for the OneDrive sync client, you'll actually see account. It'll actually tell you which account and where the storage is. What you might find, you might see multiple accounts listed. That's probably creating the challenge. What I'd probably recommend doing, potentially remove or unlink all accounts. Make sure everything looks correct when you navigate via the web, and just make sure there's no duplication there. And then for that device, the question is, do you want to see one of those accounts or do you want to see both of those accounts when you open up Windows Explorer or the folder view? If you only want one of those accounts, go into the OneDrive settings, only add that one account, and hopefully as soon as it starts synchronizing, you're going to see everything that you want to see. This is a feature, you might say, for OneDrive. If you're using the web interface, they usually have a really easy button where click here to synchronize to my computer. That can easily recreate kind of those two accounts on your device again. The only way to undo that is to go into the OneDrive sync preferences, go to the account, and unlink that account or stop synchronizing that folder, and it should remove it. But my guess is that's kind of what you're seeing is you have two accounts you're synchronizing on your device. Go into your OneDrive account preferences, and I would check there to see if you do have both. Once again, my guess is you are going to see both. Unlink the one you don't want or stop synchronizing it, and hopefully that will solve the issue. But just to make sure there's no duplication, open a private or incognito browser window and log into each account using a different window. Then you'll at least be able to compare both of them and you'll actually see it. If you do see that some files for work are stored in the personal folder or vice versa, you can at least remove it using the web interface, put it into the location you want it to be, and then hopefully that will allow you to kind of deconflict the two. And that will eventually synchronize to your other devices if you have the OneDrive sync client. But I would check the OneDrive sync client first. I'm guessing that's probably where it is. I've had the same challenge because I've had multiple Microsoft accounts, and I've had it where all of a sudden, like, oh, I have multiple accounts synced to this one device. I really didn't want that. It's kind of confusing. They store in different folders. It gets just kind of messed up. So give that a shot.
Give it a shot, Jan, and thank you very much for calling. Jesse LeGrue will be with us right up until 12:30 today to take your questions, and you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Jesse. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking technology on the program right now. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. It's great to have him with us today. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call. Mary in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Mary, hello. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Yes, I was on my phone the other night at 10:30 talking to my friend, and then all of a sudden I heard dialing, like they're pressing the numbers and they're dialing, and my friend did not press the dials for dialing, and then and it happened again, and it hung up, and then I called him again. I go, did you do that? Were you dialing? He goes, no. So later that night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, he said he got a phone call from me, and he answered it, and it wasn't me. I was sleeping. So I don't know. Sometimes I think there's somebody in my phone, and I can take it off the air. I hope I explained it okay.
Yeah, I think you did. Jesse?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So if it's a cell phone, I mean, normally it's not going to be like a, and I think we, at least for those of us who have had landlines in the past, it's probably not a new experience to have somebody else pick up the phone and start dialing, because you could have one phone kind of shared amongst the whole household. But usually in a cell phone, that's going to be a little bit different. So usually the connection you're going to have with somebody else in the other line is going to be really between you and them. There's not going to be generally anyone else kind of on that line. So I'm kind of curious in terms of where that connection came from. There are possibilities if there is software running. So if you have your cell phone, you're talking to somebody else, in theory, you could hear the sound from other applications running on your device, which if the sound did come from your phone and no one else did hear it, could there be a possibility there's some kind of malware on your device where somebody could be either listening in or could even introduce sound? In theory, it's possible. Usually in practice, it's going to be a little bit more challenging, but that could be a possibility. Maybe there's some kind of bad software on your device that could be doing it. Whether that's related to the phone call your friend received from your phone number is uncertain. So the challenge with our existing phone system is it's relatively insecure. So it's really easy to pretend to be somebody else's phone from an application on a device or in a different way. So it's possible that the phone call they received was not even from your device, was not even from your phone number, and that somebody tried to kind of falsify it. They tried to spoof, in other words, which is the term for kind of falsifying that information. They tried to pretend that they are your phone number and called your friend. So it may or may not be related, although the timing is kind of interesting from you actually hearing that dialing from when they received the phone call. What I'd probably recommend, so if you do have an iPhone, if you have an Android device, I would kind of keep an eye if you do notice any other unusual activity on your device in terms of it running unusually slow. I would go through your screens where you can actually see the applications that are installed, see if there's one that looks unfamiliar. If you do see unfamiliar items or if you know you're not using it, uninstall them. And that'd be another thing I'd probably take a look at. Or maybe ask yourself the question, did you install any new applications on your device? Maybe a new application might have been malicious, and maybe it should be removed or is creating that challenge. But normally, you shouldn't be hearing that from other individuals. I haven't at least experienced it with my own cell phones in the past. Could potentially a signal be received from a totally different line that you're actually hearing a different phone call? I think I've had that happen on landlines in the past. I've actually think I've had that happen once or twice. I don't know if I've experienced that in the cell phone. That feels a little bit more challenging to kind of have that same overlap. But I would kind of keep an eye on it, take a look at any applications that you might not need and uninstall them. If you do get really concerned about maybe there's something actually on my device and I'm not sure about it, I'd also recommend taking it into your cell phone provider. One, they're usually going to have methods to back up your phone and potentially wipe it and reload all your software and bring back in your data. If there happens to be any bad software, usually a full reset of your device and then restoring the data you need should hopefully resolve it. So if you do get really concerned about there being potentially something bad running on your device, that could be a really good option, and usually a service center. They've done this many, many times, and they can walk you through backing up your data and can potentially also assist you doing that yourself. Whenever, if I'm going to bring my own cell phone in for a service center to do something, I try to back up my own data first, just in case there's some kind of accident. And that way, you know, you always have your own backup data if you need it. But likely they can help either validate that with you, or even help you with a system restore if they think there's a different issue.
Mary, thank you for calling. Let's turn to Phil in Mount Horeb. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Hi. I'm interested in keyloggers. I've been aware of these for a decade. I fear them because if someone nefariously installs a string of software on my PC and I'm an individual investor and they can record the keystrokes, they can record the logon keystrokes, and they can also record this secondary access. I don't understand why keyloggers aren't a greater threat, or if maybe they are and we just don't know it. But I'm, you know, if you're talking about your investments, it's something you want to protect. Can you explain the keylogger pros and cons from a keylogger's standpoint and how to defeat them?
Yeah, and that's a great question. So there's a couple things to think about for a keylogger. So let's say somebody does want to record what you're typing on your keyboard. There's a couple ways to do it. One, they actually basically try to compromise your keyboard. So you can actually insert like a physical device between your keyboard and your computer that can be used to collect and potentially transmit that information. And there are, you can actually get them relatively inexpensively. So as somebody trying to protect themselves against a keylogger, check your physical connections, check your keyboard, check the plugs that you have in between your keyboard and your computer. Have they changed? Is there an additional device? If you want to be extremely careful about it, note the serial number of your keyboard or other pieces. So if somebody replaces the keyboard itself, that could also be a challenge. So you'll know, you know, more in terms of how much of a risk that is based on who can get access to your physical device and everything else. If it's in a locked location and it's really hard for other people to get to it, maybe it's not as much of a concern, but that's something I'd take a look at. The other piece to take a look at is software running on your device. So your computer needs to be able to know what you're typing so it can listen to your instructions and take action. There could be software running on your computer that's also collecting that information and taking it somewhere else. Usually the best protection against that is going to be a lot of the traditional ways to protect your device, antivirus software, or what they might call EDR or endpoint detection and response software. So built into Windows is Microsoft Defender. That will generally help to address a lot of those concerns. there are other antivirus products for Windows that you can purchase. And all of those products will usually detect a little bit of different things. So there are benefits to thinking about different options. I will note, so for some of those devices that you can kind of plug into your computer or in between your keyboard and your computer, they actually might get detected by some of these endpoint detection response or antivirus programs. So it just depends on how the device was engineered. They might be able to detect that hardware as well. But honestly, the best way, look at your device. It can be really easy to not see one small thing in between your keyboard and your computer. If it's underneath your desk, if it's behind your computer, you might not look at it all the time. So it can be really easy to just plug another device in. Your keyboard still works fine. It just happens that there's something else detecting your keystrokes, recording it, and it doesn't necessarily need to transmit it, but it's an easy way to get that data outside. Otherwise, somebody might need to collect that device. So think about both ways. Install antivirus, make sure it's updated. I would recommend for anyone that's a lot more concerned with those kind of items, when you're using your computer, don't use a user account that has administrative rights that can install software. You can have a different account that you use to install software, but that means you may not unintentionally install software that could be dangerous. There are still other challenges with that as well. But once again, we're trying to reduce the risk by adding all of these little things. So anything you can do to reduce that risk will be helpful, and not running as an administrator. Checking your devices for any device tampering is really important, and making sure you have antivirus to scan for malicious software can be extremely helpful. And, you know, don't install software unless you know you need it, and make sure that you install software from organizations or companies that you trust. And if you want to make sure going forward everything is safe, take a look at your add or remove programs or anything else you're using to uninstall or install software, because then you can see, ooh, do I know what this is? And if you don't know it, maybe it's something to take a look at. It could be software that is doing something you don't want it to do. So regularly auditing your device can also help detect whether something changed and you didn't want it to be there.
There you go, Phil. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Joe in Oshkosh next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I have a question about DuckDuckGo. Is it a reliable source for people to use, or what do you know about it?
Yes. And actually, I'd say it's a lot of people do use it. So most people use that for a couple of reasons. One, you can use it as your web browser. So it is a web browser replacement for Chrome, Firefox, Edge. It should run on... I think it runs on Windows, Linux, and Mac OS. So you have multiple options in order to use it. And they also have a search engine, which allows you to collect information off the internet. So you can use it in a couple different ways, depending on which route you'd like to go. I'd say overall, it is an okay web browser to use. I'm not sure if I'd say it's any worse or than any other browser you might already have pre-installed on your device. And I can't recall whether it was DuckDuckGo or a different browser. One thing I always recommend with any kind of third-party software, you can also take a look at other different user reviews with whether it's functional for them. DuckDuckGo tends to be a privacy-focused browser, and so with that is to limit the data collection that you have on your device, or to make your presence a little bit more anonymized. So when you do browse different sites, it shares limited information, or at least information that a data broker or a company can't use to combine and be used for directed marketing, data resale, or other pieces. So in terms of just general safety, I think it's an okay browser to use. And feel free to use it. Same thing with the search engine, you know, depending on your day-to-day use. But I think it's okay.
All right, Joe, there you go. Thank you. Karen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I'm calling because in reference to the caller, I think it was twice before, two people before. I've been talking on the phone and have a conversation on my cell phone come in to the into my conversation, and I can hear them talking, but they don't seem to be aware that I'm there unless I don't even want to say anything. I just want to hang up or call the person back. It has happened twice.
So what could be, and you're on it, and this is on your cell phone, Karen.
Right. And but the one thing that I have is I managed to save my old landline, but I heard your guest say is this is definitely an iPhone. I am definitely on an iPhone.
Okay.
With my old landline. And it's just like when it used to happen on my old landline. I don't know. I mean, I'm not annoyed because so far it hasn't happened again. And maybe it's just been fixed.
Interesting question, Jesse.
Yeah, and normally it's something called like a call collision. So somehow, you know, phone calls get intermixed and you end up kind of overlapping the phone calls. I don't have a great answer, although it may be, it possibly could be provider specific because it would rely on the infrastructure, all the technology in the back end to connect one device with another. And it makes me think there might be some kind of challenge there, which is causing that overlap. If that's the case, there's likely nothing you can do on your device itself because it's all based upon the cell phone providers and how they're connecting those calls. I might also recommend reach out to your cell phone provider and actually give the feedback or the note to them. They may also have additional information. I could see this potentially being provider specific, but since you know you're on one end of the phone call and somebody's on the other end of the phone call, there's a lot of things in between that, including it could be multiple providers. So chat with the provider and see what they say. I think that might be, you might get some other details that I'm otherwise unaware of.
Yeah. What sort of fact-checking or content regulation, that's another email, exists on Blue Sky? Is what they are doing part of what is making that platform more popular?
Oh, that's a good question. And so a lot of people have been using, I think, Blue Sky specifically, primarily due to people, I guess, not wanting to use or moving away from Twitter or X. And it really is kind of an open source platform people use for social media and for networking. In terms of the moderation that they're doing on the back end, I'm not certain of all the controls that they're doing on the end to kind of centralize the moderation of content, whether it's for hate speech or for fact checking. I actually do not know exactly how it's done, but it could be similar. It could be different. I don't think I can speak too much on it.
Okay. Another email read, there's a planned Microsoft data center that will be built in Racine County. Data centers use between 1 million and 5 million gallons of water a day, and the upcoming Wisconsin one will recycle its own water. Anyway, what is a data center, and why does it require so much water?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, a data center is really a collection of computers that are used to process data. Every time you go to a website, there is a server that's sitting in a data center, or maybe multiple servers in multiple data centers serving you that web page and a lot of the content that's there. And so it's used really for the infrastructure of the internet and a lot of the services that we use on a day-to-day basis for installing applications, making phone calls. So even phone calls, there is a server or multiple servers somewhere providing that content. Why so much water? Well, generally, a lot of data centers, your computer, any device, you might have noticed it gets a little warm sometimes when it's working really, really hard. Well, in a data center, they have a lot of computers generally working pretty hard to do a lot of the things we ask it to. And especially with machine learning and artificial intelligence, it requires a lot more power, it requires a lot more energy, and our devices heat up. To help cool those devices, a lot of times water is used to help with cooling and to also transfer that kind of warm water and energy elsewhere. And so it you can kind of think of it as a cycle where cold water is brought in, that water heats up to try to take the heat away from the other sources, and then it goes somewhere else, which is then cooled again. And it can happen in the cycle. So a lot of water is needed in order to do that, but it might be used for other infrastructure as well.
Tina emailed to say they have seen people posting a statement on Facebook, and I've seen that too. It would just information to stop that platform from using their photos or other information. Is that something that really actually works?
It does not. And so people can post, you know, don't use my information. Generally, it's still going to be in their privacy area. But there's a lot of posts, I think, similar, and it might be specific to Facebook, but I've seen it for other things where people will post, and it's not that there's a promise behind it, but in most cases, it's used for other purposes or other kind of like social engineering or data gathering. So a lot of those posts and repeat are usually things I would recommend not engaging in this case, to ask Facebook or Meta via a Facebook post that you don't give it permission generally isn't going to actually do the thing you want it to do.
Okay. Annie, maybe one more question. Annie emailed to say they never used Facebook Marketplace but would like to sell something on it. Any advice on how to ensure your security using Facebook Marketplace?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question. So I think there are a variety of challenges. One is you might have fake sellers, and you might also have fake buyers. So a lot of the content, be cautious of. If you are going to sell something, I would recommend being careful in terms of what information you give other people. So whether it's your phone number, your address, have a way to at least vet the individual or individuals responding to your post in terms of keeping some of your data private and trying to make sure that the other person on the other end of the line is who they say they are. I would just be careful with that. Just like any stranger you might meet randomly on a telephone call, how you make sure that you're safe. And it's kind of the same methods here. Be careful and assume that the person on the other end might actually not be the person you think they are.
Okay. On that note, Jesse, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure, and we'll look forward to another visit. Thanks, Jesse.
Looking forward to it.
Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, our guest. And he'll be back in a month or two, and we'll do this all over again with him. Coming up, we are going to take a look at the new technology with hearing aids. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, hearing aid technology has come a long way in the last several years. They're less bulky, they're cheaper, you no longer need a doctor's prescription, and the new ones are loaded with tech that can help you track other aspects of your health. And with us today, Rachel Lee. Great to have her with us, a UW-Madison Clinical Associate Professor and audiologist. She also serves as audiology ambassador for the American Speech Language Hearing Association for Wisconsin. Great to have her here, and I hope you'll join in the conversation. Maybe you have problems hearing, but you don't want to, let's say you're putting off getting hearing aids. Maybe you've tried some new replacements like Apple AirPods or iPhones. What questions do you have? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Rachel Lee, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
How many people suffer from hearing loss?
That's a great question. So primarily with the over-the-counter, which we'll be talking about today, we're thinking about adults. So adults aged 19 and older, there's about 37.5 million Americans who suffer with hearing loss. Of that, only about 16% in the 19 to 69 range do something about it. And over 70, only about 30%. So a lot of hearing loss and not a lot of folks doing something about it.
And people really would benefit, those who have that issue. Why do they avoid getting the hearing aids?
That's a great question. I think that it's multifaceted, right? So you mentioned before people are putting it off. It might be due to the stigma. I think that that's reducing a little bit, but some people don't want to have a visible device on their ears. They think that hearing loss is associated with being older and they don't want to appear older. I think that cost is a big barrier, and that led to where we are in our hearing healthcare market today. I also think that some people just think of hearing loss as a consequence of getting older and they just put up with it.
Yeah. But it really could impact the quality of your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hearing loss is associated with a lot of things. Social isolation, that can lead to some depression and anxiety. It can also affect cognitive ability. There's a lot of good research out there that there's an association between the two. So, yes, a lot of consequences other than just not being able to communicate when your hearing loss is untreated.
In November, I think it was, this past November, Apple released AirPods that, when paired with the latest iPhones, can be used as hearing aids. How significant do you think this technology is for people with hearing loss?
Yeah, well, the thing to me that's most significant about it is that it addresses the access issue. So they're not very expensive compared to traditional amplification and hearing technology. So I think that it's wonderful to get more people to try something for their hearing loss. I think that the technology is also there for the right person. I think that that's what we consider when we're thinking about AirPods, other over-the-counter devices, and traditional hearing aids. And we're thinking about what does that user need, what's their life like, and does it fit in? And I think that for some folks, the technology in the AirPods can help.
How does it work? It works between your phone, I assume.
And yes. So, of course, you need to have an iPhone, which that in and of itself can be a barrier for some people. But, yes, they work just like other wireless headphones connect to the iPhone. And then you have the ability within an app on your iPhone or within your settings to adjust how much you're hearing of the ambient noise in the room. You can adjust how it sounds to you. So it's all an interface on the iPhone. So if you're already an Apple user, I think it's pretty user-friendly.
Yeah, I'm already an Apple user, so it would be my hearing's pretty good, so fortunately. But, you know, when I see somebody with AirPods in, I'm probably going to be more reluctant to talk to them.
I think you're right, and I think that's probably one of the big disadvantages of this technology is you don't know what someone's listening to when they have their AirPods in. Are they listening to music? Are they listening to radio? And I agree. I think people won't necessarily, you know, communicate or get the attention of somebody if they look like they're listening to other media.
And they kind of stand out. I mean, there are other devices that are far less.
Yes, right. So it doesn't really address the stigma in that way, because absolutely they're very visible. I think, though, that we are getting more and more used to seeing things in people's ears. So in that way, I think it can help reduce the stigma of using something in your ears. And, you know, you could think about it either way.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, I think it was two years ago, the Food and Drug Administration started allowing hearing aids to be sold over the counter. Mm-hmm. Has this resulted in cheaper and easier to get hearing aids?
Yeah, so there's a big market out there, and I think there's a lot of devices that are available. Whether or not people are accessing those devices, I think, remains to be seen. There was a survey a couple years back, and the American Speech Language Hearing Association, which you mentioned, piloted that survey, and it showed that not a lot of people, even though, you know, we waited and waited for these to be available, were actually using those devices. So I think it remains to be seen. It certainly has been a shift in the industry. But I think that having more options, as I mentioned earlier, opens the door for a lot of folks to think about their hearing health.
And there are other hearing aids that use wireless Bluetooth connections to listen to phone calls or podcasts and music, of course. How reliable are these?
That's a great question. So I would say that it's pretty reliable, or at least as reliable as Bluetooth is. As we all know, any of us who have used Bluetooth technology, it can be a little bit finicky. Sometimes you lose the connection, you have to repair. But I would say overall, very stable connection, very good, clear quality streaming. And a lot of folks love that about their hearing aids nowadays.
Yeah. Blake emailed and said he is a firearms instructor in Madison. He teaches students to always double up on hearing protection. What considerations are those for those with hearing aids participating in shooting sports?
That's a great question, Blake, and thank you for suggesting your students double up. That's exactly what I would recommend as well. And I think that we cannot think about any type of hearing aid, whether it's over-the-counter or prescription, as a means to protect our hearing. So if somebody is a firearm user and they utilize amplification, I would always recommend that they take those out in those scenarios. That can be difficult, you know, if you are hunting or something and you're trying to listen for very low-level sounds. But there are devices that amplify that and then detect an impulse noise and kind of clamp down and protect the hearing.
Oh, interesting. I was thinking about my dad, who was a champion trap shooter and skeet shooter. And so shooting hundreds and hundreds of rounds, shotgun rounds, he always wore a protection. But over time, I think it affected his hearing anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So we're thinking about noise as a two-prong issue. So it's not only the intensity of the noise or how loud it is, but it's also how long we're listening for, and it's cumulative within a day and over time. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not surprised.
Lois in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I'm wondering, for a person who's been tested by audiology at UW Health in Madison and was told their hearing isn't bad enough to have a hearing aid, but yet the hearing isn't getting any better, what can that person do? Just wait and be retested, or do you have any ideas?
That's a great question. So there are a lot of different things that could lead to that recommendation. We have sort of benchmarks and ideas about when a hearing aid will be worth the cost. So as with any decision a consumer makes, there's a cost-benefit analysis. And I think if the hearing loss isn't quite as severe, you know, I think some audiologists make that recommendation because of the cost of traditional amplification. But for me and many audiologists, the most important thing about hearing aids is that you are motivated and that you notice a deficit in your life. It's affecting the quality of your life. So, you know, I think without knowing the specifics of your results, I think getting a second opinion would be reasonable, or retesting. Traditionally, with any hearing loss, we recommend you get evaluated annually and revisit the question at that point.
Yeah. And even if they say, if you're told by whoever you're working with that, well, you don't really need it, can you just get one anyway?
You could, absolutely. I think, yeah, there's lots of different scenarios. And, you know, if people are in very challenging listening environments, that hearing loss may affect them more. So I think, you know, you want to advocate for yourself. If you feel like you need some assistance, you need some amplification, I think it's reasonable to advocate for yourself and revisit that question.
I've always passed those tests, but I do notice, like, when I'm listening, watching TV with my daughter, she will always want the volume turned down.
Yeah, that's a very common thing in a household. Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Lois, thanks again. Appreciate it. Perry in Oconto will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Perry.
Yes, hello. I have a question about the hearing aids and hunting. I have a pair of, they're supposed to reduce the noise reduction by about 22 decibels, but they're also FDA approved for use as a hearing aid. But the problem I have with them is that the sounds don't sound natural when I have those in. Of course, they block off the ear canal and everything, and they have their microphone to amplify it. Any tips or tricks? Because when I can even hear my feet walking on a floor when I have them in.
That is a great question and something that I encounter on a pretty daily basis in clinic. I think that the best piece of advice I have is to just continue using them. When you're new to something, your brain takes a little bit of time to acclimate. You have to kind of reteach yourself how to listen to those certain things. So the example of hearing your footsteps, that is likely audible to somebody with normal hearing. Your brain, if you're not hearing that as well without the devices, is going to pay a lot of attention to what it feels is a new sound, a new stimulus in the environment. So the best advice is to wear them as regularly as needed for hearing, and then hopefully those sorts of things won't be quite as noticeable.
Perry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rachel Lee, our guest today, UW-Madison Clinical Associate Professor and Audiologist, also serves as Audiology Ambassador for the American Speech Language Hearing Association for Wisconsin. Great to have her with us. Questions for her as we talk about hearing aids. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at hearing aids today on the show and hearing with Rachel Lee, UW-Madison Clinical Associate Professor and Audiologist. Great to have her with us today as we talk about those hearing aids. There's a lot of new things out on the market and certainly worth talking about. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Question, how do you get your hearing tested? Is there a standard test that needs to be administrated by an audiologist, or could it be done by a service online? And I think there are ways, for example, with the AirPods, there's an online kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a great question. So for anybody with hearing loss, I'm biased, of course, but I do think that a full comprehensive evaluation with an audiologist is a good first step, whether or not you're going to continue seeing them for amplification. There's a lot of value in doing that. But with the over-the-counter devices, they're self-fit, and traditionally that means that you would also do some sort of either online test, or with the AirPods, with that specific case, it's part of the app or the function within there. It does a hearing test. I don't have any evidence on the accuracy. I only have anecdotal evidence, and that is that it's pretty comparable to what you would see in a hearing evaluation with an audiologist. The one caveat, of course, being that you're not in a sound-treated booth, so it may actually show that your hearing is worse than it actually is because of ambient noise in your environment affecting your results.
Ed in McFarland has a question. Hi, Ed. What's on your mind?
Hi. My question is, I have mild hearing loss and not so mild tinnitus. Wondering what the latest you know about helping people with tinnitus is.
That's a great question. A lot of people who have hearing loss also suffer from tinnitus. And I think that hearing aids or amplification is always a good first step. I think that when you have tinnitus, and we don't know the exact cause of it, but we are learning more and more all the time about it. When you have tinnitus, the theory is that the brain is not receiving a signal from the ear like it once was because of hearing loss. And so there's this sort of phantom signal that comes in. So the thinking behind amplification is that if you restore that strong connection between the ear and the brain, that it reduces that tinnitus or that ringing. So a lot of folks do really well with hearing aids when they have tinnitus. If it's more bothersome and it affects your ability to concentrate or to fall asleep, read a book, then I would certainly talk with a healthcare professional about it, your physician or an audiologist, and then there are additional steps you can take.
It's kind of weird. I have a little bit of tinnitus too, but a lot of times I will not be aware of it at all.
Yeah, and it's sort of this negative cycle where if you're thinking about it, it's more prominent and it goes round and round. But, you know, that is just person specific. So if somebody tends to be more bothered by those sorts of things, it may make their tinnitus more noticeable.
I didn't notice it at all until Ed brought it up.
Oh, no. Thanks, Ed.
I do thank you, though, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Tim in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm actually calling for my mother, who's in her 90s. And she had a virus that took away the hearing in one of her ears, and it's terrible in the other ear. And I kind of have two questions. One, is there a cochlear implant that would help with the ear where she's lost her hearing? And or is there an over-the-counter hearing aid that has sufficient volume to help somebody with severe hearing loss?
Those are both great questions, and I think I'll answer your second question first. So an important thing to think about with over-the-counter devices is that they are intended for people with what they call self-perceived mild to moderate hearing loss. It sounds like in your mom's case, that wouldn't quite be appropriate. And in that case, it wouldn't even provide enough amplification for her to be beneficial. So she would potentially, as you stated, be a candidate for a cochlear implant. The one thing to think about is how long she's had the hearing loss in that ear. That may affect her success with the cochlear implant. So I would definitely recommend that you, take the steps and do the evaluation for the cochlear implant and see if she's a good candidate.
Yeah, there you go, Tim. Good luck. Thank you. Bill in Wausau, we'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. With regard to tinnitus, when I had my first experience with it, they told me if it rings, don't answer it. But my problem now is I've had hearing aids for a number of years prescribed by a commercial place, a storefront place, and they've been working good. And I had a problem over Thanksgiving not hearing what was going on and over Christmas. So I went in and asked to have them readjusted, and she gave me another test. And she said, you're just above profound or whatever that word is. And she said, what's been different? And I said, I had COVID over Thanksgiving. And she said, some people have hearing loss because of COVID. So now I'm in the midst of deciding, do I get the better technology she's talking about, at X number of thousands of dollars? I've got an appointment with another real audiologist in a clinic to see what happens. But one of the things she tells me is that the technology of the hearing aids amplifies certain frequencies and ranges, and I have trouble hearing certain kinds of voices. Can you talk a little about that and a little about the cost-benefit ratio for people in their 80s who are in my situation?
Hmm. Absolutely. All great points and great questions. I think that the over-the-counter devices would not be great for you, given that she mentioned that the hearing loss is in the profound range, or at least a portion of it. I think that it's important to work with somebody who is going to adjust the hearing aid to be very specific for your hearing profile. You probably hear differently in the low pitches than you do in the high pitches, and the hearing aids should account for that. I also think that your examples of Thanksgiving and Christmas and having a challenge listening in those environments, you want to think about the technology in the device. The hearing aids nowadays, so much energy is put into improved hearing in noisy situations because pretty much everyone with hearing loss struggles in those environments. The more sophisticated technology is going to do a better job of reducing that background noise, or at least not amplifying it, and honing in on what you want to listen to. So that's a discussion, you know, the cost benefit, but also a needs assessment. You need to talk with the audiologist or whomever you're working with about your life, what sorts of environments you're in, and then you work together collaboratively to decide what technology is best for you.
All good points, Bill. Thank you for calling. Tom in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been told I could use hearing aids. I've noticed that I have some difficulty determining what consonants might be being said by people. But I also have a condition called hyperacusis, where certain tones really irritate my ears. And your guest has been talking about amplification. And my concern is, how do you balance the need for hearing aids with a concern about certain sounds being amplified and just, you know, irritating you all the more?
Hmm.
That is a great question, and one that, you know, is a plug for working with an audiologist, because audiologists are the experts in hearing loss and how humans hear, but we're also well trained in disorders or conditions like hyperacusis. And I strongly feel that amplification is not a one size fits all approach. I think it's very important to work with somebody, tell them your concerns, and then they can, within the software, adjust the amplification in certain ranges. So if you are bothered by more high-frequency sounds or high-pitched sounds, like, you know, dishes clanging is a common one that people report, they can adjust the maximum output of a hearing aid in that region to make it more comfortable for you.
Tom, there you go. Thank you. Jan in Beaver Dam. Hi.
Yes, good morning. My problem is I have severe tinnitus, and I'm seeing an audiologist on a regular basis, and I have hearing devices that are supposed to help mask the noise from the tinnitus, but so far, no success.
Hmm. So it sounds like some adjustments are needed there, or perhaps a different device, Rachel?
Yeah, I think, you know, without knowing the specifics of what device you're using, I think maybe in addition to device, there are some other strategies, and it's not my area of expertise, but there are other strategies such as cognitive behavioral therapy and other things that will adjust the way that you think about your tinnitus, and you can get some relief there. So I'd recommend working with somebody who is trained in treating people with tinnitus, maybe as their specialty.
All right. Jan, thanks. And John, a quick question from Appleton.
Thank you very much. So I'm a pediatrician, and I got a friend of mine asked me, I got this feedback from a local over-the-counter shop saying, I have an audiometric airbone gap equal to or greater than 15 decibels at 500, 1,000, or 2,000 hertz. recommending they should go see ENT. And their question for me was, well, can't you just sign my form so I can get some over-the-counter hearing aids? And I wouldn't do that because I'm not evaluating them. But what can I tell them? The issue is that they've had childhood ear infections and probably perforations. And should I just tell them it may be that over-the-counter amplification isn't going to work for you and you should have a more evaluation?
Just to clarify, is that for a child or for a friend of yours or someone you know?
I think it was for
an adult friend.
For an adult friend.
You got 20 seconds
okay,
to 20 close
seconds.
Here, or even 10 seconds.
Okay, so I would just say a quick answer is that seeing a medical professional would be good in the case of an ear bone gap.
There you go. And I thank you so much. Obviously, we need to have you on again. Thank you very much. Rachel Lee from the UW-Madison.